Okay, as has been announced, we're starting a study this Sunday on the book of Romans. And one of the reasons we're doing that is because Lance did a survey and trying to see what people were interested in and what they wanted to study. And when that survey came back, like the highest numbers were in Rome. People wanted to study Romans, people wanted to study Isaiah. And they were both about equal. Well, with Isaiah being 66 or how many ever chapters, I felt like that was quite a bit of material for somebody like me to try to wrestle through and to do it in a way that would, you know, we wouldn't be in Isaiah 5 years from now, and hopefully won't be in Romans 5 years from now. I don't think that's going to happen either. So I chose the book of Romans, and it was really kind of interesting when Jimmy came to me because personally I had been wanting myself, not in the order to teach a class, but to sit down myself again and to go through the book of Romans for myself. And I had been preparing to do that. I just never had gotten around to it. And so when he came and asked me to do the class, there was a lot of hesitancy because one of the reasons I wanted to sit back and do the book of Romans myself was because over the years, my understanding of Paul, my understanding of Judaism, my understanding what was going on in the first century has changed a lot through what I believe to be, you know, good information and things that I've learned. And so with this, I didn't pull out old notes and pull out anything else. I had to start from scratch again myself. And a little bit of that, and it has been very, very challenging for me. Incredibly challenging. And I felt that sometimes, like, I mean, in the last, I don't know when Jimmy told me that he wanted me to teach, and I agreed to do it in a weak moment, and he asked me, and I said yes, and I have pretty much just been hammering away at this, and at times thinking I was going to have to call Jimmy and say, you need to get somebody else to do this, you know, because the challenge of it has been tremendous. And I can assure you, if anybody ever says to you in some kind of braggadocious way that they've got Romans all figured out, don't believe anything else they ever tell you. Or consider that person to be incredibly prideful or at least not aware of all the issues that are there. But it's interesting. It is a wonderful book. And I have, once I've gotten through that initial part, it has been incredibly rewarding for me. I hope it will be for you. And Martin Luther, of course, and we'll talk a little bit about him later on, whose life and all of church history was incredibly changed by his reading of Romans. This is what he said. Romans is worthy not only that every Christian should know it word for word, by heart, but occupy himself with it every day as the daily bread of the soul. It can never be read or pondered too much, and the more it is dealt with, the more precious it becomes, and the better it tastes. And I think Luther's right. And that has been my experience thus far. And he might have been a little over the top to say it has to be read every day, but everything else he said about Romans is true. It's funny, I was reading one time about N.T. Wright, and you'll hear his name a lot in here, and a New Testament scholar that has been an incredible help to me over the years in a lot of different ways. When N.T. Wright was in graduate school, I think when he was in graduate school working on his doctorate or after that, at some point, anyway, he read Romans all the time. And he read Romans of course, he's a New Testament scholar, so he was reading Romans in the Greek, memorizing it in large sections, if not the whole book in Greek. And he was reading Isaiah in the Hebrew all the time. Isaiah, Romans, constantly. And so, and one of the things N.T. Wright was trying to do with his new understanding of Paul and many of the things that were going on, he was trying, just like I was doing, only I hadn't been doing that. I've just been reading Romans in the English and referring to what Greek tools I still have. But again, just coming at it and trying to grasp what was the situation, what was Paul really talking about, what was he saying. Some of the things that I may say, so, let me ask this back up. How many of you have studied the book of Romans before? Okay, quite a few people, and I kind of expected that. And because I know especially in our tradition, the Church of Christ, Romans became a very important book for many of us. When the Church of Christ really began to kind of change and kind of evolve into a place we are today, I really think that Romans and its message of grace and a lot of the issues dealt with there, it became a very important book for us, just like it was for Luther and the early reformers. And I'm not comparing, our tradition to the Roman Catholic Church or the issues Luther was dealing with, but there were similarities in a lot of ways and a lot of our struggles. So, I may challenge, well, I know I will probably challenge some of your cherished views about what Romans is saying. I don't think I will challenge the main message of Romans and the fact of God's grace and His salvation of us in Jesus. And that is going to remain intact. But how we get there and how we see Paul getting to that may be a little challenging. It may be a little different. And there's going to be times where we're going to have to just trudge through some of this argument. But we have got to try to understand what he was saying. Paul did not sit down with Romans and write a systematic theology. That is not what Paul did. That is not what Romans is. Paul was an apostle and a pastor. And he was writing to the Roman church, one that he had not founded, and we'll talk about that later, but one that he had not founded, but one that he was coming to. One that he knew by people that he was connected to in the Roman church. He knew the problems and he knew the situation. And so, like any New Testament letter, this is written in an historical context. It's not written in a vacuum. It is written to a specific church at a specific time with specific issues. And Paul himself has a specific agenda. An agenda is not a dirty word. He has an agenda, a missionary agenda, and one of the things he is doing is setting out his gospel to this Jewish Gentile church in Rome that is struggling to learn to live together as community. Paul's been preaching the gospel for about 25 years at this point, and so we know the story of Paul, most of us do. We know all that he suffered, we know all the debate, we know all of the things that he was constantly dealing with. And out of that whole experience, he sits down in the book of Romans, writing to this specific church to explain to them his passion for the gospel and the righteousness of God. And in doing that, he is laying out the gospel that he has preached, and he's laying it out to help them deal with their problems and also for them to understand him. And so that's why it is crucial for us to understand what is he saying. Before we start trying to say, what is it saying to us, we have to say, what was it saying to them? If somebody picked up documents 2,000 years from now and saw phrases like 9/11, Al-Qaeda, Bush, Cheney, all these things, 2,000 years from now, and if we were kind of in the same situation that they were, where all we were doing was handwritten documents and a few fragments and things here and there, you can imagine the task. Somebody coming into that discussion 2,000 years later would have to define those terms. They would have to understand what were those people talking about, what was the history, what was the political situation, what was going on. What are they talking about? And so we have to do the same thing. It's the position that we're in. One of the things I want to do today, even though I know most of us have been in Sunday school for a long time, is I do want to set this in its historical situation, and I want to talk about Paul some and how he fits into this historical situation so we can kind of begin to understand his mind. And when he came to Jesus and when he began to preach the gospel, out of what historical and theological context was he preaching that? Now, I will say this, that the book of Romans is filled with theology. But again, it's not a systematic theology. But everything Paul is saying is very theologically loaded. And Paul had an incredibly robust mind. Incredible. And I love Paul. He was brilliant. And when I was in college and translating the letter of Romans, and a little bit more talk about that, but man, you'd be reading, and then all of a sudden he'd just go this way and this way, and then he'd come back and he'd go out and he'd come back, and you know, you've talked to people like that, and their mind's just so robust, you know, and they're just, you know, just and you know, it wasn't that he was scattered, but he just had this incredible robust mind. And sometimes you'd be reading in Greek, and it's just, of course, in the original Greek there was no punctuation or small letters. Of course, we were reading not that kind of text. Ours had punctuation and stuff in it, as the texts do now that scholars use. But, I mean, these sentences would just go on forever, you know. I think it's in Ephesians that third 3 through about 18 or 20, that's one sentence in Greek. Now, can you imagine, you know, talking to somebody and listening? So what I'm saying is Paul has an incredible ability. He's a beautiful writer. And what he will do is sometimes he'll touch on a theme that he's going to come back to 2 chapters later. He'll touch on it, you'll hear it, and you'll say, whoa, give me more. And he'll say, hold on, we're going to get there. But right now this is what I want to say. But hold it in your mind. Hold this one in your mind. Hold this one in your mind. And then he weaves them all together. And so our task and my task as a teacher is to try to keep weaving that together as we go through here and to see this main message. And I do want to take time to stop and reflect and say, what does this mean for us now in the 21st century? What does this mean? What implications does this have for our life with Christ? And what implications does it have for our belief? The historical situation, many of you who sat in the class on Luke know a little bit about this, and I'm not going to cover it as much in detail. But I do want to talk about the historical situation. Obviously, when Paul came along, he came along at the same time Jesus did. And Israel was under the Roman rule. In 63 BC, they became part of the Roman Empire. And Rome had been ruling over them. And you remember from the Luke class, it was an incredibly oppressive situation. Even though the Romans were smart in the fact that they allowed people to maintain their own religion, they still kept an iron hand on things. And we talked a lot about this in the book of Luke, and some of you weren't here for that, but you can get it in my book that was published, 10 copies for my best friends, and none of them have bought it. So, but it was that was done. But anyway, Israel was under incredible oppression. And by the Romans and by their own people. And so what was going on is that there is a controlling story going on in Israel as how they understood this situation. And it's a controlling story that comes from the Old Testament, of course, which was their scriptures and which was the early church's scriptures, basically. Israel had been called in the beginning through the covenant that God made with Abraham. And when God made that covenant with Abraham, He called this group of people out of all the peoples of the earth to be His covenant people, to be the light to the world. And the whole point of the covenant was always that this people would lighten the dark world, and that through this people, God would bring, He would set to rights what was out of joint. He would set to rights what was wrong in the world. Through this people and through this covenant people that He had made, He would rescue the world from sin, disintegration, evil, and ultimately death, and all of the effects of sin. One rabbi said that God created Adam, but that He knew Abraham. God created Adam and planned that if he went to the bad, He would bring Abraham along to straighten it out. And so that's kind of how the Jews looked at it. They understood that they had this special calling from God. But Israel, the messenger, the covenant people, had become sinful. And as a result, they had gone into exile. And we know that the final exile was with the North Israel went under Assyria, and then South Israel followed. Judah followed under the Babylonian exile. And they went into exile as a result of the fact that they had become sinful, that they had failed in their role to be a messenger. And then in the 530s BC, they had returned from exile. And during the exile, all the prophets, And before the exile, you have Isaiah, you have Jeremiah, and then the exilic prophets, you have Ezekiel carrying over into that time, and Daniel carrying over into that time, and then you have Zechariah, Malachi, and the other prophets. They all kept looking for this time and prophesying this time when God would return Israel from the exile. And so Israel did return from the exile, and they did rebuild the temple. And Herod had started a massive rebuilding, refurbishing and remodeling the temple, and it was a beautiful, incredible sight. But the point is, every Jew, and I'll refer to this period as Second Temple Judaism, which starts in about 530 B.C. all the way through A.D. 70 when the temple was finally destroyed by the Romans and never rebuilt again. But all the Jews in Second Temple Judaism, for the most part, believed that the exile had not completely ended. And we talked about this a lot in Luke. Even though they had returned to the land, they were still a people in exile because the pagans still ruled over them. And they were also still in exile. The prophecies had not completely been fulfilled because Israel herself was still incredibly compromised and sinful. And so the curse that they were under for violating the covenant had still not been fully lifted. And so what you have is this incredible question and this passion going on. When is God going to finally bring us out of exile? When is He going to do this? And a lot of the things they looked to was they realized that, first of all, that the prophecies of Zechariah had not been fulfilled. There were not 10 men holding a Jew's skirt and saying, "We will go with you because we've heard about the God that you worship." Yahweh, and when I talk about Yahweh in here, I'm going to use that term, and of course I'm talking about the divine name that the Jews used. We really don't know how it was pronounced. That's probably as close as we can get. But Yahweh had not taken His stand on Mount Zion and to defeat the nations that opposed Jerusalem. Ezekiel's new temple in Ezekiel 47 had not been built where the rivers of living water would flow out to heal and bring healing to all the nations. Isaiah chapter 40 through 55, this time of peace and prosperity and forgiveness. And Isaiah 2, when the nations of the earth would come to Jerusalem to hear the word of the Lord and the Torah, none of that had happened. And the fact is, as long as a pagan ruler was in their land, ruling them, and occupying their land, they knew they were still in exile. But there was a high fever pitch at this time. The Qumran texts talk about that people were standing on tiptoe, waiting, looking, thinking that it's about to happen. And that maybe already in the Qumran sense, the Essenes, and in the Pharisaic sense, the Pharisees, were already the people who were being formed for when God would finally and climactically act in history to bring Israel back to her glory, to defeat the pagans, and to punish the renegade Jews who were not keeping the Torah the correct way. And so there was this incredible expectation that God was going to act. Messianic movements had happened, and they would be crushed. People would rise up and say, "I'm the one," and it would be crushed. Back in, I think it's 163 B.C., the Maccabeans, had regained the temple from Antiochus Epiphanes. And people thought this was the fulfilling of the prophecy. And so you have this incredible fevered expectation for the kingdom of God, that the kingdom, the rule of God, to bear upon this world, for Israel to be freed from her enemies, for sinful Israel to be punished along with the Gentiles, and for Israel to be brought to her glory and these prophecies fulfilled, the time was at hand. And so Paul is a Jew in this whole expectation, this theological expectation, this hope, this longing. And Paul was a Pharisee. We know that. He tells us that. He tells us that he was a Pharisee among Pharisees. And the Pharisees were one group of people who saw themselves, as did many Jews, that their role was to hasten this story to its ending. They believed that through their obedience to the Torah, that, and let me define that phrase because I'm going to use that a lot in here. Most of you know, when I'm going to use the word Torah, because law has been a kind of a confusing term, and we use it in so many different ways. But when Paul in Romans is talking about the law, and I know this is already maybe questioned by some, but just right now, just kind of settle on that. It's the way I'm using it, and then we'll talk about it later. Basically, when Paul is talking about the law, and when the Jews talked about the law, they were talking about the Torah. Sometimes that referred to just the first five books of the Old Testament. Sometimes it referred to the whole Old Testament scriptures along with the writings and the prophets. So I want to use that word because it's got a little more Jewish flavor to it. And so Paul and the Pharisees, what they believed their role was to help bring this story to its ending. And what they believed that Israel needed to do was to keep the Torah, and that by observing the Torah, they would hasten the time of the fulfillment of these promises. And in order for Israel to keep the Torah, Israel would need to be reminded, and they would need to be urged to the task. And let me say this, and we're going to talk about this more a lot in Romans. This was not a self-help moralism. It was not works righteousness. That was not the point. They believed that the Torah, they believed that they had been brought into covenant relationship with God by grace, and that it was always by grace. Grace was not a new concept with Christianity. It was not a new concept to Paul. It was not a new concept to any Second Temple Jew. And they kept the law, and they believed that they should keep the Torah out of gracious thankfulness and gratitude to God. They believed that to keep the law was the way that they showed their appreciation to God for making them people of the covenant by His grace. Now, we might could argue that in their emphasis on the Torah, did they move over into almost a soft type of legalism? And we're going to talk about that. But I think we badly misunderstand, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but we badly misunderstand the Jews of the first century if we believe they were a bunch of legalists running around thinking that if they kept the works of the law, they could make themselves good enough for God. That is not what they thought. And the Jewish writings of that time have borne that out. Were there legalists who did think that way? Well, of course. I haven't ever known a religion to exist, and especially Judeo-Christian religion, where that didn't exist. And it could exist in this room. I mean, we can all fall into that subtly. We wouldn't say it sometimes, but we think that way. And so, yes, it was there, but the main heart of the theology of Second Temple Judaism, and even in the Old Testament itself before Second Temple Judaism, was never this idea. If you look to Exodus chapter 20, it begins with what? Does it begin with grace, or does it begin with law? What does He say in the beginning of the Ten Commandments? What does God say through Moses? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. And then the law is given as a way to show them how to live as covenant people. So for the Pharisees, you can understand Paul, and he was Saul then. You can understand the young Saul and the Pharisees if you understand this concept of zeal. Zeal. Zeal for Yahweh. Zeal for the Torah. Zeal for the traditions of the fathers. And if you don't understand that zeal as a legalism, but you understand it as a zeal of trying to help the people be the holy people of God, prepared for God to be His people when He acts climactically in history to fulfill the prophecies and to bring Israel to her glory and to bring her to the place that she was always supposed to be. And so, in thinking this, Paul believed, and the Pharisees believed, that it was their duty to urge and to remind and to enforce the Torah and to punish when they could. They did not really have the legal ability to punish people. That was with the Sanhedrin. And that's why Paul, when he begins to persecute Christians, he has to get permission from the high priest in order to do that. But the Pharisees, of which Paul was a part, believed that this was their task. And they also believed that violence could be used when necessary. If it took that, then it took that to clean out the land and to rid these renegade Jews and others from violating the Torah. It was an intensification of Torah obedience in order to be the pure people of God, ready for God to act at this climactic moment in history. So I hope you're getting an understanding of Saul within Second Temple Judaism. You're getting an understanding of his hopes and his beliefs and his passions and what he believed was going to happen and what he himself was standing on tiptoe waiting for. Paul was not a mean, cruel person is the reason he persecuted Christians. He wasn't a man filled with Satan as the reason he did that. He was a man who believed passionately what he believed, and he believed in the enforcement of the Torah, and that's why he did what he did. That's why he went after Christians. Because for him, they were sitting loose on the Torah, they were criticizing the temple, they were hanging loose to the Sabbath and circumcision and all these types of things. Well, the Jewish Christians weren't. I take that back. That would come later with the Gentiles. But Paul understood the Christians as basically just one more group of renegade Jews who needed to be corrected, brought back in, and if violence was necessary, then so be it. Now, what's interesting about this is, though, that the Pharisees, there were two different groups of the Pharisees. There were the Hillelites and the Shammites. And the Hillelites, of which Paul studied under Gamaliel, who was a Hillelite. In Acts chapter 22, I think, or 23, I've lost my reference, he tells us that he studied under the feet of Gamaliel. Now, Gamaliel, if you'll turn to Acts chapter 5, I just want to show you this real quick. And again, I'm just setting the historical context, so bear with me here, and hopefully this will all mean more as we begin to talk through Romans. I know this isn't life-changing, and you're not going to walk out of here on a fevered pitch after studying this. And it's Acts chapter 5, excuse me. Beginning at verse 33. When they heard this, they were enraged and wanted to kill them. And it's talking about the apostles. But a Pharisee in the council named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, respected by all the people, stood up and ordered the men to be put outside for a short time. Then he said to them, "Fellow Israelites, consider carefully what you purpose to do to these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up claiming to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him, but he was killed. And all who followed him were dispersed and disappeared. After him, Judas the Galilean rose up at the time of the census and got people to follow him." You see the messianic movements that are coming. "He also perished, and all who followed him were scattered. So in the present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone. Because if this plan or this understanding is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. In that case, you may even be found fighting against God." They were convinced by him, and when they had called in the apostles, they had them flogged, and they ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. Gamaliel was a Hillelite, and their main philosophy was live and let live. Obey the Torah, study the Torah, keep your head down. God's going to do what He's going to do. Live and let live. They were passionate for the Torah, but they were not like the Shammites, of whom Paul, even though he studied under Gamaliel as a Hillelite, was actually more of a Shammite, because the Shammites were more of the extreme right wing of the Pharisees, and I'm not using that in a pejorative way. But they believed, no, you don't just live and let live. We've got to take action. We have to purify the land. This zeal for Yahweh, this zeal for the Torah, this zeal for the traditions of the fathers has to be enforced. And so what he does, his teacher, beloved teacher would have told him, you know, you're taking the wrong route. You need to back off. You need to cool down. You need to study to the Torah, teach the Torah, follow the Torah, and God's going to do what He's going to do. And that's not a whole lot different from Christianity today in some ways. We don't use violence, well, not anymore, in this land. We use verbal violence sometimes or whatever, but you can kind of still see this. This is always going to happen in religion. What do? We need to take more action. We need to do this. We need to do that. We need, you know, so, and then others say, no, just follow, keep your head down, study the Torah, follow God, and He's going to do what He's going to do. So this was Saul before his conversion. This was Judaism in its historical setting. Is that clear? Am I throwing too much out there? You kind of get a feel for where we are. So what happened? What in the world happened to this Saul to change everything? To have him preaching eventually after his conversion in the 30s, preaching and saying that one, Jesus is the Messiah, and two, that the Abrahamic covenant, God's covenant, has been fulfilled, but it's not through Torah. Can you imagine how radical that was for him to say that? I wonder sometimes if he even was amazed at the own words that were coming out of his own mouth. And we'll see later, what is the relationship of the Torah to the Christian? What place did it still hold? What place did it have? What place does it hold for us now? All those things will be explored in Romans. But the bottom line was, this is what, and you tell me, what happened that changed him? And I know it's a little Sunday school type of review, but what happened? I don't need the whole story. What happened? I can't hear you. He met Jesus. And not, what convinced him? What changed him theologically? What shattered him? And rocked his world when he saw Jesus? Did he just see a vision, or what did he see about Jesus? I mean, some argue that it was a vision. I'm not going to get into all that debate, but what did he come to understand? That Jesus had been raised from the dead. That is the key. That is what changed him. Because one of the things I left out was this. Every Jew, except for the Sadducees, believed that when God acted climactically in history to bring Israel to its glory, to stamp out the pagans, and to heal the earth, that the one thing that would definitely happen is the resurrection from the dead. That would be the sign. Not just the fact that Torah would be enforced, and that Israel's enemies would be defeated, but the resurrection of the dead would happen. They believed that. And they believed in the resurrection of the dead. It may have not been as fully formed as our Christian understanding, but basically a Jew and a Christian would have had no difference in their understanding of the resurrection of the dead. And you see, the great hope for the Jews, as it should be for us, is not how do I get saved and go to heaven. And I know you've heard me say that before. Not that that's unimportant. But you see, this whole idea is not that God's going to blow this world away and do away with it, or that the greatest existence is in some ethereal plane floating around in a disembodied soul. The idea is this earth is God. It has been ruined by sin, not completely ruined. It still shows the glory of God. And there are still beautiful and wonderful things. But sin is a problem, and its effects are felt. Evil is felt. And the great hope is for when God acts climatically in history, death will be overcome, the dead will be raised, and this creation will be brought to the glory that it was supposed to always have. It is this. This is what is the hope. And it is God's cosmic restorative justice, as one scholar says. That's what the Jews hoped in. And so it was not focused, it was focused as an event that would bring history to its climax, but it was not this Platonic idea that what's physical and what this world is evil, and you don't need it, and it's just a hindrance. No Jew ever thought that way. Well, I say no Jew ever thought that way. The Second Temple Judaism, their theology, and the theology of the Old Testament did not think that way. This earth is God's, and His cosmos is God's, and He's going to bring restoration. And the resurrection of the dead would be the one sign that it was happening. So what happened to him? He sees Jesus raised from the dead, and his world was rocked. Because what Paul, who he became Paul then, or at some point, a little bit after that, what he did is this. He realized that the one true God had done for Jesus of Nazareth in the middle of time what he, as Saul, had thought he was going to do for all of Israel at the end of time. And that's a quote from N.T. Wright, but I can't say it any better. The one true God had done for Jesus of Nazareth in the middle of time what Saul had thought he was going to do for Israel at the end of time. Continuing with Wright's quote, the great reversal, the great resurrection had happened to one man all by himself. Saul had thought that Jesus was anti-Messiah. He had thought that Jesus couldn't be the Messiah. These Jews are idiots for following him. He was crucified. He was defeated just like Thutis and just like Judas the Galilean. He was just another failed renegade Jew. The Messiah is not going to be crucified. The Messiah is not going to go down in defeat. And so that's why Paul, another reason that he was so passionately against the Christians. Because it just did not fit the theology. They were out announcing that the kingdom of God has come. The kingdom of God is here. Jesus is Lord. Jesus is Messiah. He is the fulfillment of prophecies. How do you get that? But when he saw Jesus raised from the dead, he knew, as a Jew, that yes, it had happened. And so he has to step back. And now everything has changed. What he thought God was going to do for Israel at the end of time, he has done in the middle of time. In one man, Jesus himself. And it was not unusual for the Jews to believe that in some way the Messiah would take on the sufferings of his people. But they did not believe he would be defeated. And that's why, for me, one of the great evidences of the resurrection is because Jews did not believe that resurrection was a resuscitation of a dead corpse. They did not believe that resurrection was just somebody existing in a non-embodied state. We don't fully understand Jesus' body after the resurrection, but for a Jew, the resurrection meant just that. It meant the person being raised, receiving the new body, the new resurrection body. And when he sees Jesus like this, he has no choice. God has hemmed him in. He has caught him. All he could do would be to deny it. But he couldn't. And his whole theology changes. His whole understanding. I can't imagine what kind of turmoil he was inside. Have you ever had your theology greatly rocked by some realization or enlightenment? I have. And it's a discomforting time. And when you come to see the truth, and this is profound. And so with seeing Jesus, the resurrected Lord, he had to rethink salvation history. He had to realize that now the present age and the age to come were running simultaneously along with each other. The already, but the not yet. This was not what the Jews believed. They believed that it would all happen at once. And that's why Jews today will tell you, if they're Orthodox Jews and they believe in a messianic time still coming, they'll say, Jesus is not the Messiah. Well, why? Well, look at the world. Resurrection from the dead hasn't happened. Israel hasn't been brought to her glory. Evil is still rampant. Death is still rampant. And sin is still rampant. Messiah hasn't come. And the same thing Paul faced. Same thing. And so what happens with Paul is not only a new understanding and a conversion to understanding Jesus, rethinking his theology, not completely, but in very key places, he also received a new vocation. He had believed that it was his task to bring Israel to her glory. He believed that it was his task to bring this story, to urge it on, to bring it on to its ending. But now he realized that that story had reached its ending. Yes, there would still be another stage of which you and I both are still waiting with Paul in. The final stage of the new age is yet to come. But he knew that it had arrived because the resurrection of the dead had happened. And with that new vocation, he also knew from Scripture that what the prophets had also talked about is that when this time came, in history, that the Gentiles would come in. Now, what he had believed is that when the Gentiles came in, they would be keepers of the Torah. They would keep the Torah, they would obey the Torah, and the keeping of the Torah is what would define them along with Israel as the people of God. And what he comes to understand in his thinking when he sees Jesus raised from the dead, and as he goes out, and as he begins to preach to the Gentiles, he realizes that no, Torah doesn't define the people of God anymore. What defines the people of God is faith in Jesus. That is the badge. That is the sign of the covenant people. That is the sign. And that is the only thing. And what he comes to realize is that what he had hoped for Torah to do, but what he realizes in his thinking, and we'll see this in Romans, that it could not do, that it had never been able to completely do, what he wanted the Torah to do, God has done in Jesus and by the Spirit. And so he receives a new vocation because he knows that now that the Messiah has come, now that the new age has arrived, it's time for the Gentiles to come in. And he was set aside by the Spirit, he and Barnabas, to go to the Gentiles. And when Paul went preaching among the Gentiles, he was preaching as a Jew. He was preaching as a Jew who believed that the time had come that his forefathers and that he had longed for. He never saw himself as anything but a Jew. He saw himself as part of the Abrahamic covenant. And he saw that now that time had come. And when he went out preaching, he was embodying the fulfillment of the prophets. He was taking the Word of God and bringing the Gentiles in to the Messianic people. He was bringing them into the new age to come. And so this is the hope you can see the historical and theological mindset of Paul, because it will be important for us to understand that, to understand a lot of the things he says in Romans. A lot of the arguments that he's making in Romans will come out of this whole theology and historical theological and historical situation. And so I hope this will be helpful in that way and to help us kind of understand, because I think often we understand Judaism, Christianity, no connection. And some of the Gentiles in Paul's day and in Roman church had begun to believe that way too. It's all about us, not them anymore. They failed. They have no place. Paul never believed that, and that Romans 9 through 11 is all about that. And so these are wedded together. And I'll never forget the time when I'll stop here. I sat down with a young Jewish man, and he was raised Jewish, but you know, kind of like some modern Jews, he didn't really pay a lot of attention. He went to synagogue school and all that. But I'll never forget the look on his face when I said, "My Messiah is your people's Messiah. Everything that I believe came through your people. It came through your history. It came through your scriptures. It is the fulfillment of all of your people's hopes. I am a Gentile who's been brought in." And I'll never forget the look on his face, because he thought Christians pretty much thought the Jews were kind of a one-time thing and cast them aside, and Christianity's all about Gentiles. And it was amazing the conversation that we were able to have just opening that door to him. And he ended up becoming a Christian and being worshiping with Messianic Jews, because it helped him to hold on to his Jewish heritage along with his new faith in Jesus. Okay, thank you for listening. I know I'm talking a lot, and you will have the opportunity to talk and to respond back, believe me. I just need to set some of this out. Next week, I want to set the book of Romans a little bit more in its particular historical context, and then hopefully we'll be able to start into the text hopefully next week. But I want to talk about the Roman church, its situation, and kind of look at the book, and then we'll move into it. So thank you.